Instead of saying your mind is your biggest liar, I would say it's the illusion of truth.
Yeah, that's true. I guess it's a different Dhamma, a different way of looking at it, a different pattern. But, yeah, you're often even creating these stories. You know, everybody does. They create, this is the way it is, this is the way. You know, the idea, like, in particular about not self, like, you know, people often take that as a fear. It's quite understandable, this idea that, oh, I'm not anything. But in actuality, it can be an incredibly liberating thing. The idea that you can actually be, you can change, you know, if there was, you know, you can just reinvent yourself. I've done that now like 3 times. Like, you know, I was a marketing executive, and I'm like, nah, I'm going to be a construction guy for a while and just change my life. And then, like, okay, well, I've been doing this practice for a while. I don't want to do this construction anymore. Become a monk. But if you had this conceiving, like, oh, I'm a lawyer, I'm a, you know, I'm a maker and a shaker, I'm a mover and a doer, and I got my white picket fence house with my dog and my wife and my Corvette, you know, I can't change that. You know, then you're locked. You know, you put yourself in a box that is subject to decay, it's subject to problems. This is the ultimate freedom of being like a monk, not having anything. You're just, there's nothing tying you down. You know, somebody says, hey, Gandanya, we'd like you to go there. Okay, give me a couple hours, I'll put my stuff in my bag, I'm ready to go. And it's, you don't have to fix things, you don't have to carry things, you don't have to worry about all the different things. And like a bird, light as a bird, free to take wherever your wings go, and hopefully you won't get blown off course. But, you know, if you got a balanced state of mind, you get blown off course, you're like, hey, I'll make a nest here.
You talk about examining the stuff that comes up when you're trying to keep your mind still and open. And you realize that it's nothing of any real importance. But the same stuff keeps coming up again and again and again, and you can say, yeah, that doesn't mean anything.
Well,
a few minutes later, it's back in a slightly different form.
Well, let me check. One thing you said, trying to keep the mind still. I didn't say trying to keep the mind still.
You know,
you're engaging in the activity, which is a difference. But when it comes, when these things come up, do you end up getting engaged in them?
Usually not. I note them and I'll just, okay, I was thinking about this and drop it. A few minutes later, something else comes up and then the first one comes back. And I know they're ephemeral, they don't really mean anything, but they just keep cycling, and I'm not sure how to...
One of the things is why it's important, like, you really do need to... part of this getting this open body experience and getting this subtle sensation, and there's a thing I've been... I wanted to bring this up in the talk, I forgot, but I knew it was going to be things I forgot, because I knew it was kind of a shotgun. Is that idea of variety, you know, moving things around? One of the ones I'm doing now is, I think I mentioned it last week, I'm doing 2 or 3 hours a day. You know, you don't have to do it this much, of like incredibly deep breathing, breathing for like an hour and a half, hour at a time. And so I'll breathe in like real deep. Nose or mouth, doesn't matter, like 30 times. And then I'll just let my breath settle into a relaxed exhale. And I might just move it like, you know, like kelp. You know, like kelp is like just sits there and like just gently moves. So I don't hold it closed, but I don't breathe anymore. And this very vigorous breathing, it's very engaging, so there's no real place for the mind to really come in, right? And then one of the things this actually does is it, after you do a couple rounds of it, it opens up the body into this very kind of tingly, subtly sensation, and that is a real good basis for really getting yourself into an open, full, conscious, and pleasant experience. And so one of the problems with the hindrances are, is that you aren't developing a way of substituting one pleasure for the more subtle pleasure. So the Buddha says, like, why should I be afraid of the jhana? Because the jhana is a pleasure that's really not born from like sensual indulgence. It's born from a kind of detachment and a subtlety. And so like that isn't piti per se. But you're getting to, because what piti really kind of comes from, my best guess physiologically, is that when you kind of open the full body experience, there's this just kind of flow of energy, like kind of like your neurons, and there's just kind of awareness. And the like very subtle things will just cause these very pleasant energies to move, and you don't have anything to obstruct it. And then when that starts happening, it's a something that gives your mind something and your body something to do and enjoy other than those other things that you're engaged in. And so until you kind of overcome the hindrances, and a part of overcoming hindrances is developing a sense of awareness of something that's more pleasant than the idea of entertaining these thoughts. Mm-hmm. And you recognize that these thoughts are dukkha. Like I had this one conversation with this guy where he backed himself into this corner where he's like, I hate my thoughts, but then I can't, if I don't think, then I'm like, I don't think I'm, like, I got to be doing something. You know, I'm like, you can't have it both ways. Like, is it dukkha? Is it thoughts a problem or are they not a problem? You can't both want them and not want them. If you don't want them, then stop engaging in them and they will go away. It's helpful, again, maybe finding something like this that's a little, like, I was kind of doing this on a whim and I brought it up Ben had a Burmese monk that he gave me a PDF for, and this guy was, you know, I don't remember his name, but he had a booklet that they had translated, and he recommended heavy breathing like this for an hour, straight, no stop, no like no changing of subtlety or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And because it is something like picking up the heaviness of the breathing or the strength of the breathing makes it like a little more, lifts it up a little more into the mind, right? It's a little more active. Or maybe walking meditation. I'm trying to do walking meditation. But you have to rely on giving yourself, because there's something in this process where you're not valuing the experience of sitting as much as your thoughts. And you have to, like, again, kind of come up with what is the solution to that. But once you kind of find that, then the thoughts will become less attractive to the mind to create. But wanting them to go away, this aversion to them, that's not going to do it. Because that's vibhavatana. That's like wanting to annihilate the thinking, wanting to get rid of it. The thoughts are arising because you've previously entertained the thoughts. And that's your past karma. You got to stop engaging in them. And find something that's more rewarding to the experience, and then they'll just stop on their own accord over time, or they'll just become like less, and or they'll be there and you won't care. That's the other thing. If you have strong mindfulness, I have found that one way of really separating the mind from the sense doors, period, is attending to just ceasing. It's an entirely different meditation technique, which, unless you've like really got pretty strongly established mindfulness, I'm not sure it's gonna work, because you get lost, I think. Mm-hmm. But you can use that. I mean, that might be something you might throw at it. This is like as you're walking around, or you know, doing like anytime something is no longer conscious. Like I see this and I look away, that's ended. I don't see it anymore. Somebody says something, a conversation ended. It's making note of the cessation of things. It's a strategy that instead of being involved in the objects of the world, then you unify the mind around their phenomenological nature of ceasing. But it's a tricky practice. But it's very efficacious to practice. But I would try that other one first.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of talk about the want to become and to add, but there's also, I think, in our Western psychology, the desire to annihilate, you know, to zone out, to not be. Could you speak about that as...
Yeah, so, like, this is where I'm going to, you know, the process of freeing, like, understanding consciousness and discernment is an unbelievably, that's what the Buddhists called the awakened one. I mean, there's no shutting it out. What you're doing is by becoming dispassionate towards objects and things and situations, your mind actually expands to take it all in. It becomes much more open and available to whatever presents itself. I'm gonna pass on the time. Thanks for taking that. So the idea of annihilation and what was it again, Sylvie?
Not wanting to be
Or shutting out the world.
So, again,
this kind of goes to the idea of full body awareness. You're starting the process. This is the beginning stage of opening consciousness to be fully aware. Like you first start, you look at the progression of the jhanas, you start with getting to full body awareness, and then eventually you get to the point where the whole concept of the body drops away, and then you get to spaciousness. And unbound consciousness, the state after that, you're actually wide awake, all the sense doors. Every sense door and everything is undifferentiated. You open up to the full experience, and nothing is lifted up at all as being something, right? It's not bound, so there is no idea of, like, Phil is there. It's just everything is, you're awake to it. So it's actually the closest state to nirvana I've read somewhere. So there is no shutting off in this practice. That's why the idea, like, often, like this idea of, like, even closing in on a point and trying to shut the world off, like, trying, oh, I'm going to stay with this point right here with the breath. I'm not going to move, and nothing's going to get in the way. That is a form of vibhavatana underlying that, that they're like, okay, I'm going to just stay here, and everything else has got to go away. And then this thought comes in your mind, like, get out of here, thought. This is all going in the wrong direction. By opening up the full awareness of the body, when things present themselves, and you let them pass and go, you're seeing the fabrications as they come, as you continue to see fabrications, and you see the paper tigers and or they just lose their efficacious nature and they stop arising, the mind just, everything just keeps opening up, opening up, opening up, and then things become subtler and subtler and subtler. And there is no pushing anything away. It's actually a radical acceptance of whatever is. Like you're just, it doesn't matter. And this is what equanimity is. It's like, it doesn't matter what happens. You know, some like, you know, the Buddha has the ultimate archetypical example is like, if bandits are carving you limb from limb, arm from arm, if you have any anger, then you're not understanding the teaching. Well, there you go. I mean, like, okay, they're chopping my arm off. Well, it's just a body. I mean, that's the extreme. But there is no shutting off, I mean, from this. You're just, you really aren't allowing anything to be present. And what I described in that process, this is the beginning part, is how that is actually done. You actually open up the full body awareness. And because really what's happening, there is this mind-body connection all the time. So kind of underlying principle that one will see over time is that if there is a thought or if there is some kind of impingement, it will always manifest itself in some way bodily as well. And so you actually also then get to be where like that's like some kind of bodily manifestation is like a dinner bell that says, okay, you got some tension here. Something's amiss, and it kind of lifts your awareness up to, you know, kind of be engaged with whatever may present itself. Or, okay, what am I not liking here? What am I getting ready to create in terms of a problem? Because the first manifestation will always actually arise in the body as some kind of tension, like, ah, I want to do something else. Or, ah. So that's why you don't want to shut off. You actually want to just keep expanding and expanding. And I don't really want to get too far down in the line into the subtleties of like, because I know that we've gone through it. It's getting to full body awareness it's not an easy task in and of itself. And really, that's where most people need to be, you know, working at. But that is a part of the full process. And you can't, I don't think you can really progress in path without developing that. So hopefully that's answered your question.
Thank you.
Okay. Something that I think Ajahn Vajiro touched on when he was talking with us the other weekend and you may have mentioned it too, is that when you sit down to meditate, it should be something you're looking forward to.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always, a lot of the time, thought, damn, I have to get my meditation in today, and I'm going to just sit down here and do it. And I'm trying to flip my attitude, but it's stubborn.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I went through probably a decade and 15 years of that. Like, you know.
Is that all? I'm good then.
Yeah. The path of suffering goes, the cessation of suffering goes through suffering. But all this stuff that you're doing and you're dealing with, it's all good. People often think, like, these thoughts arising in my mind are, like, the problem. No, that's, like, that's the process. That's suffering, that's arising, and that's what you're going to, that's the practice. It's not, like, bliss isn't the practice. It's not suffering anymore. And so you have to go through a stock of suffering. Especially most Westerners aren't used to sitting, like, you know, in these positions. And are not used to sitting still. You're like, oh, you're not being efficient. You got to be out there making a living and producing society. You got all this stuff going on. And so we have this kind of reluctance to sit. But we're working on ourselves. It's very tough work. And so there's all the... So part of it is might be helpful to you is recognizing that's just it. And that's part of what I was trying to say is, like, you gotta suffer in this. It's like, you know, I said to myself in the beginning of this talk is, like, and you get people talking about, like, seeing castles and fairies and unicorns, mm-hmm. and all this fancy dancy stuff, and I'm like, I think it was probably like my fourth or fifth year I was doing the Goenka course, and I, like, Goenka has this idea of any bodily formation is a sankhara, which, yeah, technically true, maybe, but I don't necessarily think that that's a useful way of approaching it. But anyway, I was convinced because I had this, because of some life choices I had made, which I won't really go into, I caused some problem in my back. And so I kept, like, changing this all the time. And I had this upper back pain. And I was convinced, though, because it kept getting worse, that it was this action that was increasing this sankhara. And so I made this determination on a 10-day course that I was not going to move. And I used to be like this when I made the decision. I'm still kind of like this. It was going to be what it was going to be. My ex-wife could tell you that. When I made a decision, it wasn't much changing. But I got on day 4 or 5. I mean, I was sitting there like with such excruciating pain that it was like a knife in my back. And I went to it was a good friend of mine, the AT, he was a teacher in the Goenka tradition. He was a part of the same board that I was associated with in developing a Goenka center. So he's a real close friend of mine, and I was telling him this. I wasn't sure if whether or not I was having a heart attack or not. Like, I mean, I'm like, okay, you know, this has been going on so long. I wonder if this, and this sort of is my mind's creating a story, but it would not stop. So I eventually, I mean, long stories, like, you know, eventually got me to do chiropractic and physical therapy, and I've basically kind of sorted this problem out. But none of that was, I mean, unbelievably painful experience and unbelievably difficult meditations, but these are the kind of things that you can expect to go through, maybe, you know? I mean, we've got monks that have sometimes had to get up off the floor and sit on benches because of pain or different things, but it's important to recognize that, like, by doing the practice, like the stability of the mind, it might be that your 24-hour day is 1% better or 2% better because of your 1 hour. You know what I mean? And you got to say, well, if I keep doing that 1 or 2% better, it keeps adding up. And so really the mind, one of the important things in part of the discernment of suffering is recognizing that you are also trading off short-term for long-term. And real maturity and wisdom is foregoing short-term gratification for long-term benefit. That's really what separates human beings and wise human beings and mature human beings from the immature and unwise, is recognizing that, yeah, it's difficult, but in the long run, it's the more skillful way to live. And so, yeah, multiple hopefully multiple ways of dealing with that issue. Is recognize the long term, recognizing the little bit of gains that you're getting by it, or whatever it may be. And again, go back to that idea of making it more engaging. Like if you're sitting down and it's something that you're dreading, try to use these other ideas of having a more active, moving your mind around to try to get the full body awareness. And it'll be a more engaging process. It's more problem solving. The mind wants to solve problems. And so if you have this objective of getting to full body awareness, you got to go find where am I not aware? Where have I got blockage? Where have I got blind spots? Okay, I'm going to work with that, and then something else will come up. It's a much more engaging 1 hour. Time goes faster, too, when you're engaging in something as opposed to trying, gosh, I got to... Okay, look at the clock. Oh, another 30 minutes to go. Oh, my God. I'm never going to take it. That's your paper tiger. That's your paper tiger right there. You know? Paper tiger's coming up, and he's hitting you with his paw. And you're like, oh, God, I hate this. And you're getting just mauled. Keep moving around. Keep doing something. Don't listen to the paper tiger. Don't look at the clock. Wait for the bell to ring. Do something more engaging. And it'll all get better.
So this body awareness is more... So you're sitting and you're aware of different body parts. You want to find the ones that you're not aware of? Or you just go through and...
You want to unify into one full conscious awareness of the whole body.
Whole body, okay.
So, you know, Ajahn Lee Damodaro's book, Keeping the Breath in Mind, last time I gave a talk, well, 2 times ago, I walked through that Anapana meditation, guided meditation, where you move your awareness, like in here, out here, in, you know, forehead, head, in the forehead, out through an arm, whatever. It doesn't really matter. It's nice to start off and get a pattern, like he's got a pattern. You start with that until you get a little bit comfortable with the idea of how you're doing it. But then again, then you start making it creative and you start moving around. And ultimately, I found one of the best ones is like expansion and contraction. Because when you're moving up and down through arms and feet and legs and like that, that actual idea of directing the mind will solidify the consciousness into an object. You're going to say, I'm going to move to my hand. Well, then you created a hand. That's the idea of what in that... Questions and answers, discernments develop consciousnesses to be understood. To be conscious of something, you are actually making it in your mind. I mean, it's a deep, deep, deep aspect of like duality and selfness and all these kind of things. And that's what you're actually trying to undermine. You're actually trying to recognize that you're creating the whole sense of a body. And there's, you know, body contemplations like the 32 parts. We did that this morning, this morning's chant. You can tear up the body that way. You can tear up the body with element meditation. Like Goenka has this scanning process, like you scan with it. And you can shift your perception, let's say, to earth element, to air, to water. And they have their various tactile sensations that you're associating with those. And so like weight. Okay, where's the heavy spots? Okay, now where's the light spots? Where's the warm spots? Where's the moving? Where do I feel movement? So you're changing the framework of whatever you're, how you're perceiving it, and all these different techniques and strategy will break down the solidity of your bodily awareness. And you'll start to have opening where that you can experience more and more of the body. And then that's the goal, is to get to a full body awareness. By getting to this full body awareness, then basically you're right at the doorstep of actually jhana and samadhi. This is overcoming the hindrances, because those things that are preventing you from having full body awareness are the hindrances. So to overcome the hindrances, get yourself to a full body awareness. And it's like which come first, chicken or the egg? Well, same situation. Overcoming the hindrances is getting yourself to full body awareness. And that might be fleeting. The hindrances may be suppressed for like 15 minutes, and then that actual suppression of the hindrances and getting, let's say, a full body awareness, and let's say, you know, jhana or at the cusp of jhana or something similar to, you know, like the suppression of hindrances, will often cause a sankhara of your mind to like kick up and say, oh, okay, well, how about this problem when your dad said this to you? And you're like, ah, crap. There goes the body, you know, like, and then it all comes crashing down again. And then this is the fun of the game, really. For me, this is the problem to be solved. You know, this is what makes it enjoyable, is this constant process of finding what's going to be next. Because that really is like, we talk about in Nietzsche all the time about things being impermanent. Mm-hmm. Like, this is going to pass, this is going to pass, this is going to pass. There's a whole way of looking at a Nietzsche, which I've been using a lot lately, is why I'm bringing it up, about the uncertainty of what's going to arise. Like, you absolutely have no idea what's going to arise in the next moment. And it's a whole different framework of looking at the present moment that is quite liberating as well. But that's the basic goal, is to get yourself into the full body awareness. So it's just a whole field of like, and that's one of the things, Phil, that's useful about that deep breathing, because a part of it, the reason why you can't get to full body awareness is because you have these different feelings or tones in the body. Like, some place is kind of hurting, some place kind of feels good, and you can't experience both of those simultaneously. Like, the Buddha has a saying, like, you can only feel a pleasant feeling, you can only feel a neutral feeling, and you only feel an unpleasant feeling at a time. You can't feel an unpleasant feeling and a pleasant feeling at the same time. Mm-hmm. So you need to get to these subtle underlying feelings, like tingly, throbby, pulsy kind of things. Like, kind of like, it's like physical static on your screen. Like, you got that static on the screen, like back in the old days before cable. You know, when you turn it to a channel that they don't have. Oh, so yeah. That's like what you can get in your body. And so by, like, this idea of deep breathing, it lifts that feeling up in your body and allows you to connect with that feeling. And when you connect with that subtle feeling, whatever you attend to, you'll get more of. If you attend to anger, you're going to get more anger. You attend to your thoughts, you're going to get more thoughts. If you attend to subtle sensations, you get more subtle sensations. When you attend to subtle sensations, you get more pervasive subtle sensations, and you get yourself the full body awareness.
Does that go along with the focus on the breath, or does that replace the focus on the breath?
It's always still in association with the breath.
Okay.
The breath is an anchor, and one of the things you realize, like, okay, imagine you stop breathing. What do you feel in your body?
Panic.
No, I'm like, really stop breathing. Let's say like 10, 15 minutes.
I don't know.
You feel nothing. You're dead.
Yeah, exactly.
So the breath is actually that which energizes life. It's what, and so when you get to these subtle sensations, you feel like the breath, and this is what's a good thing again about this heavier breathing methodology, is like, wow, I breathe more, like this oxygenation of the tissues, where, and this is kind of like an intellectual understanding, causes everything to be more tingly, it causes lights, it causes all kinds of physiological changes. And that's because you're energizing and oxygenating the body. But you actually, like, I don't know, you know, yoga or physical therapy, stretching and stuff like that, they're often saying, like, breathe into the muscle, or, you know, and breathe into the stretch. That is always something that's kind of available to you. And it's actually, I think, incredibly therapeutic and physical as well. Like, that wherever you are attending to, I think that the body is actually more engaged in oxygenating and the parasympathetic nervous system. I could probably go off on some kind of theory that I have no idea is true or not, but I think there is some validity to it. So many people have different lines of thinking that tend to support that, and my own experiences support that. I've had physical problems that breathing into it over time has improved. I'm not giving medical advice, but the breath is the anchor, and the whole body, you use that as association. So, like, you're breathing as you're moving up and down. Like, you could do this way, you could do spirals or all these other kind of forms that are associated with the breath. But eventually, like, you can get to this, like, when it's full body, where it's just like the whole body is expanding and contracting all the way down to the tip of your toes. Just everything is expanding and contracting. And it's still the breath. You're still associating with the breath.
When you see those movies, those people in the mental institutions are banging their heads on the wall is the point actually just to, they're trying to change your brain so they forget the painful memories?
Well, you know, it's really, 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 really hard to know. I have right now, I'm on my third book. Two of them I'm halfway through, and I kind of moved to this other one because I felt it was more instructional on the basis of schizophrenia as a
coping mechanism,
as a self. It's a coping mechanism. All selfing, all creating of self, is a coping mechanism. Even a wholesome fabrication of self is a way of coping with the world, because the world is chaos. Like, it's so much data, it's so much potential, it's so much that you have to create some kind of, and this is what human beings are doing, they're creating a self as a refuge to buffer against the world. And so, you know, and the Buddha has this. And one of the reasons I'm kind of looking into it, because he has a saying, he's like, people, he calls them patujanas, uninstructed worldlings, is a translation, as opposed to the noble disciple. He goes, the uninstructed worldling, not knowing the Dhamma, only has two strategies to avoid suffering. Sensual indulgence or going crazy. And these three books I'm reading, two of them are by psychiatrists and one of them is by a philosopher who I think might have been crazy. So he might have been speaking from personal experience. talk about how, schizophrenia, like, eventually it gets to the point where everything just collapses and crushes and there, you know, there's probably no reaching them. But that these are actually strategies of protecting oneself from certain or not proper development in, like, formative years, 2, 3, 4. And those self-strategies try to solidify, like, a barrier between the world, and then eventually at a certain point that strategy is self-destructive and it destroys that kind of core that's been trying to hold the world at bay. And I don't know, I can't really speak too much to it because I probably need to read these books a couple times and probably do more to understand the nature, but to me, like, on the surface it makes complete sense. He gives case examples and case studies. Now, that's not exhaustive, there might be other examples, but yeah, it seems to be like with the. I've read some of the dialogues, and I completely understand exactly what the person is saying and doing. And the traditional psychiatrists have misread it, and he I think properly interprets it, and you can see how it's a strategy for coping with the world, and it's a failed strategy. So then at a certain point, you know, banging your head against the wall, or violence, or paranoia, personality breaks. They're all, the Buddha would say, and these psychiatrists say that's what it results. But it's a lot of karma, you know. So it's years and years of karma. Like, you know, I was talking earlier about listening to music or, you know, entertaining certain kind of inventive thoughts. Those are hard to get away, but those are fairly benign. They relate to the world. If you got a strategy of relating to the world that's delusional, that doesn't really accord with reality, eventually you're going to back yourself into unreality to such an extreme extent that you can't associate with reality at all.
I have a theory that young people tend to commit suicide more if they believe in an afterlife.
If they believe in an afterlife?
Yes.
I don't think that that's the case.
It doesn't make a difference.
I think that, I don't know the statistics for sure, but I've heard other statistics. And I would think that would not be the case. But I don't really know. I mean, I'm not going to debate some statistic. I don't know, but other statistics would, I think, infer that that's
doesn't make a difference.
No, I mean, well, generally, I came from this, like, atheist, non-religious belief. They tend to lead you to a nihilism, which is like, if there is no self, then there, you know, it's really easy to take that negativity or that annihilation view and spiral yourself into a black hole, you know, or like a negative state of mind. Whereas if you have a view of something permanent, it might hold you. I mean, some, you know, it's got its own traps. but I think you're less likely to, you're more likely to value maybe like an afterlife or someone else. Do you have some statistic or reason to believe otherwise?
No, I think it's that if you believe in heaven, you would more likely want to go there sooner than later.
Well, except for later. I mean,
if you're really unhappy right now.
You have to take, I think, the whole, like, so a lot of these things, even if you're like an atheist, you know, you get the kind of baggage that, you know, our whole culture is built around Christianity, more or less. You know, there's a lot of the underlying principles of, around the negativity of that, or the fact that, you know, that is an act of not going to heaven, like suicide. The Greeks had this idea that the gods gave you life, and if you were to, gave you your life for a purpose, and I think some of this even bleeds into Christianity, and by ending that gift prematurely, you're denying the purpose of God giving you life, and on the basis of, like, you not embodying the purpose of why you were given life, and is a affront to the God or gods that gave you life to begin with. So they're going to frown upon you because they've given you a miracle of life. And really, life is pretty freaking miraculous. It's pretty, pretty amazing. We don't look at the absolute, like, it's just incredible that we're aware. Like, what is this whole consciousness thing? This whole, like, knowing and seeing. I mean, philosophy and neurology, anything you look at, it's like a miracle. Even the science, they think they're so close, but they still have absolutely no idea what's really going on. You know, like if you put you in a big giant donut MRI and they poke you with a needle, like, oh, there's some blood going over here. Well, that doesn't really tell you much. You know, they really don't know what that really is. I mean, the idea that there's a knowing of that pain, like, what is that? It's just absolutely incredible. So, yeah, that's the basis why it might be, you know, you're basically denying the God or gods the purpose of giving you life and putting yourself above them. Like, well, they've given you life, well, I'll show them. I'm going to take it. Well, if they've given you life, well, they certainly can give you grief. And that's why I think most of the spirit traditions have come down quite hard on suicide, because it's for that very reason. But there is actually, from what I heard, some like Indian, South American, you know, tribal religion. I did hear a statistic that these people had this kind of belief that of an afterlife, and yeah, they were quite inclined to, like, not having a good day. I think I'll kill myself. But that's pretty rare. And I don't think it's, and obviously in the Buddha's teaching, because you have to have there's self-hate, you know, there's got to be a futility. You're going into that with a mental thought, a mental image of yourself in the world that's negative. So you're not going in the right direction. You're heading in the wrong direction. And yeah, it's not a good idea. It's quite a bad idea. Does that answer your question? Okay, well, I think we're gone. Come over here.
Arahang Sammha Sambuddho Bhagava Buddham Bhagavantam Abhivadyam Svakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammam Namasami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sangham Namami.